Hello and welcome, everyone to you missed the pre-talk banter. We went from topics of a very adult nature to
it sped up so smack quick.
Croak. Yeah, you know,
it was like the wheel, and it was just like topic. Then we started the show.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys ever saw the Mythbusters where they tried to make the truck work with square wheels. That's about as well as our pre-talk show banter was going. It went forward, but it was really bumpy and rocky. So bringing you this very special, largely non-magical and what? Shut up. I'm doing my intro. MTG Potpourri is bringing me my very popular but interrupting co-host, Conley.
What? That's how I get introduced?
Yeah. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting horse.
Interrupting horse.
Gotcha. I've been learning my kid knock-knock jokes. And joining me there, who actually was willing to play along with me, is Adam Siborski.
He wasn't willing to play along with you. He fell for your stupid joke.
No, I intentionally... I knew what Tom set up as soon as he said knock-knock, so I just ran with it because I knew where that was going.
Give Tom a enabler this time.
I've got so many knock-knock jokes.
I'll take our turns being the Tom enabler.
Well, let's save a good one for the end, all right, Tom?
All right, guys, this is MTG Potpourri coming to you every week on the lovely...
Every week?
Whoa. Pretty close. We've been pretty good lately.
Recently every week, but it's a new thing for us.
Big old air quotes there.
It's like the iPad 2.
It's the Royal Weekly, you know, the Royal We. All right. So this is a quasi-regular, potentially weekly podcast talking about magic topics and other random topics, hence the potpourri nomenclature.
So, guys, we start with magic.
Yeah.
Always.
Should we go right? Let's keep them getting the potpourri flavor. We're going right into it. So, for potpourri posse, I want you guys to talk about
the potpourri posse.
Is that potpourri posse? I put that on the Twitter feed.
I feel like we can't hashtag that because nobody will ever be able to spell it correctly.
there's a lot of double letters.
That's
in there.
Precisely why we're going to hashtag it.
And we'll take up about half your tweet. It should be that the potpourri posse at gatheringmagic.com. That should be the whole hashtag. I'm tired. I'm going to go to bed. So, guys, we had a couple of big Grand Prix this weekend. And, Adam, you were actually there, and I know, Conley, you had some thoughts. So
he was at one of them. He was at both of them.
He was at one.
Yeah.
Unless they've cloned him. I'm glad they are using that technology to have two Adams on two different continents.
That's what we need.
All right. So, guys, what Grand Prix happened, and maybe share what formats they are?
Well, Grand Prix Paris was happening, obviously, in Paris, and it was constructed. So, more dragons took here, and basically a lot of the, you know, it's just showing the kind of the shift in the metagame. So, there's a lot of established archetypes and a lot of consistency in some of the decks, particularly like popular control decks like Esper Dragons has kind of been on the talk of the town. Dem Protector type decks with Deathmist Raptor were kind of enforced to beat up on them a little bit. But it's really just kind of like a rotation of decks kind of as the format continues on. Like, it's fairly mature. People know what they're looking for and are trying to metagame week to week is just kind of what the lessons. But
I actually view it, the top eight heads, I mean, if you want to be liberal, I would say five archetypes in it, because the adds in this were, there were two of them that were kind of similar in that they were planeswalkery and a little bit slower, and then there was a more aggressive one, and then there was two mono red lists. So those were the only repeats. Everything else was kind of unique. And really what I think we're seeing is there's a little bit of a shifting at the top, like the decks that we're seeing, there's a bit of a metagame shift. But I think in reality, it's just that there are a ton of viable decks, and each one of those has a chance to win any tournament given the percentages of the other decks that show up. Like, you can win, like, people thought Mono Green was dead. It top eight at Mono Green ramp with Nykthos, top eight at this tournament. I had red for Xenagos, I think. But, like, people ruled that deck out because people were playing Esper and things that just beat up on it. And it shows back up and wins just because Esper is a few numbers down right now because people weren't, like, looking at it as highly. But the Mono Red decks are still viable. All the Abzan decks are still viable. Teemer is viable. There's like three or four different weird Bant decks that are viable, going from Super Friends to like Den Collector, super aggressive decks. You have multiple control decks. The Mike Flores deck can win any tournament if it just shows up and preys on other control decks. There's Abzan Control with Planeswalkers. Like, the format has all kinds. It's one of the healthiest formats I've ever seen in Standard. Like, probably top five for sure in my playing days. And I think it's awesome for deck builders. Like, I think while the format has quote-unquote matured, like Adam said, It has not stabilized ever. It hasn't, like, settled. There's no, like, best deck, which is awesome. Like, when the Delver takes off or Callblade takes off, the format still has also matured then, but it's just, you know, we're left with shitty King of the Hill where one deck just sits up there the whole time. But this format is, like, all kinds of things viable. Deck builders can still look for new interactions. I just wrote an article for TCG Player that'll be going up, where you guys already read it, I guess, that actually I look to combine the Chromanticore Soulflayer deck with the Mike Flores Dragons deck. So I basically take the Chromanticores out of the deck, jam 8 Dragonlands in and a bunch of those big dragons, have a reanimator package for the dragons, and then also have Soul Flayers. So you can cast your dragons through your like storage lands. You can reanimate them with Fearsome Awakening and have gigantic lifelinking things. Or you can just Soul Flayer out a big dude by like removing 2 or 3 dragons, getting a bunch of keywords and being awesome. So I think there's all these like weird little tinkery decks that combine 2 or 3 ideas right now that people can still try out. Like Sidisi kind of fell out of favor, but that like the just the graveyard strategies, but that deck's very popular or very powerful. It was one of the best decks, if not the best deck, for a 2 or 3 month period. So I don't know, I think we'll just keep seeing different and old decks just popping up in top eights, and it'll be kind of hard to make sense in terms of like a rhythm, because it's mostly just going to be like, well, this deck didn't face any Esper this week, it won. This deck avoided all of its mono-red bad matchups, it won. And you're just going to see different things popping up. I would say Abzan's probably going to be there the most, just because it has 3 or 4 varieties of itself, so you're just going to see a bunch of Abzan lists. But outside of that, basically everything is viable, which is awesome.
Can you tell me a little more about the mono-red list? Are they talking about the kind of, is it mono-red devotion, or is it something different?
No, there's a couple of different ones, but they're mostly aggressive. There's a tokens variety strategy, and then there's also like a more all-in heroic style red where you're using like Titan Strength and whatnot to like power out big abilities on your monsters with spears and stuff. And then there's more of a tokens variety that's kind of like red-white tokens with just the red stuff. And they're both used like Rabble Masters. They both have a lot of the key components of like Stroke Flames and Lightning Strike and whatnot. Very aggressive. Nobody's really using Purphoros, although I think that deck is 100% viable. People basically are not running it because it has some weaknesses. And it doesn't necessarily shore up the strengths that it needs to make it a better choice than other decks. But I do think it is a viable deck if you just happen to get good matchups. But yeah, I think honestly there are probably 20 decks you could show up right now at FNM and win with. Like when we're talking about the metagame, or at least me, I'm talking about the high level metagame, like Grand Prix, Pro Tours, maybe PTQs at the lowest thing. But for an FNM, you could show up with just about anything. Like this format is wide open. There is no number one deck that you have to have hate for. You can basically show up with a good proactive deck and take down any FNM.
So I mean, just like you said, that you like the variety. Does that make it feel more random though? Where even though you have a great deck, like you said, it just may depend on the metagame that day.
You're looking to do a couple of things. You're looking to basically prepare for as much of the field as you can. So you look to prepare. You don't prepare against specific lists. You prepare against maybe specific cards if they're really dominant, but generally strategies. So it's like, what do I do against the Den Protector, Graveyard, going long, grind me out strategies? What do I do against Crazy Dragon strategies? What do I do against the aggressive strategies? And as long as you have some ideas of what to do in there, it doesn't necessarily matter if your opponent shows up with mono black or mono red. You know, they're going to have tools against you because they were looking to construct their deck to beat you. But all you need to do is take the tools you do have against aggro and figure out how to apply them to that matchup. From there, you basically, you know, you're left with what you're left with. Maybe you have a slightly unfavored matchup, or maybe it's only a 50-50 matchup or whatever. But at that point, like, you can't really beat yourself up because the metagame is so open that you just need to have general plans of attack. Or if you know you have very specific weaknesses, like let's say I'm playing a deck and my only deck I lose to is Esper, then my sideboard should probably be built to beat Esper and ignore other strategies. So it's really hard to have a sideboard slot for every single deck in the format. You're either going to have one card per deck, which is just not something that's going to help you, or you're going to have a sideboard that's just like super split up and not able to actually execute a logical game plan. Like, let's say I bring in 1 disenchant against, or 3 disenchants even, against a deck playing like some equipment that's annoying or whatever. That's awesome that I have an answer against his equipment, but like, what am I doing against the rest of his deck? Is the equipment the only thing in his deck that I was afraid of? Probably not. There's probably some strategy he's doing that's beating me up, and now I've like tried to split myself up so much that I just can't do it. So it's good to like pick a game plan. Like, here's my aggro package, here's my mid-range package, here's my control package. Go with it. You're going to face some weird stuff along the way, but just have somewhat of a proactive game plan is really strong, or have gigantic catch-alls like Ugin, Crux of Fate, versatile cards like Hero's Downfall over Ultimate Price. Like, Ultimate Price is a really bad card right now. I think you should not play Ultimate Price because it's just so specific. Your opponent can show up playing Deathmist Rappers and you're happy, or they can show up playing Fleecebane Lions and whatever, and you just can't kill anything and you're bummed out. So, figuring out cards like that, like which one's a little more versatile, which one can I get away with, which one kills more of the threats I know about in the format, making those decisions in deck building is, like, really important right now, and I think it rewards people who are, like, diligent about looking up, you know, more versatile options than people just happen to know about.
And did you have any thoughts about the Parasim before we jump into your home turf?
Of course, I have no thoughts.
What do you mean? I'm a blank slate.
Currently went to a lot more depth. You know, I mean, I feel it's at a point for at least the high level tournaments. If you can successfully guess what you're going to be playing against. In a general sense, and really you don't know because there are so many viable decks.
Magic decks, in a general sense.
Of course. If you sit down and your opponent has a Yu-Gi-Oh! Deck, you may be in trouble.
No, or you won already.
Judge!
It's actually a coin toss at that point. But the format is maturing, so you're seeing some of these like hybridized decks and strategies, and I think... That's really what we're going to see until the next big rotation comes, is just pushing the limits of like what these decks can do against kind of like the other general strategies that are also pushing back against them. It's really interesting to see like when something like Green Devotion comes back up, you know, it's because it's something that's just fallen so off the radar. It's like the Magic Online kind of problem where like people start doing very interesting things on Magic Online because they're so deep on the other decks that are doing well in Magic Online that they look really different from, you know, what they might expect otherwise. It's just something off the radar that they're not even looking at anymore.
I wouldn't be surprised if, like, Jess Guy Ascendancy combo or something, like, just randomly won a tournament coming up just because, you know, nobody's expecting it. It has some cool tools in it and does things that, you know, it lost to Anger of the Gods. I guess it's probably weak to Edict, which is maybe a reason it's not good right now. But, like, just randomly a deck like that, like, has not had success in forever, but does something very proactive and unique. Like, those types of decks, I think, could just come out of nowhere and win a tournament because everyone else is kind of just fighting over these random mid-range slots and Den Protector flipping and returning Deathmist Wrappers. And so, I don't know, I think that basically anything can do well if you just, like, pick your spots right, pick your week right, figure out the metagame and just kind of go with it. Also, whatever your local metagame is actually probably more important right now than the high-level metagame. Because, like, there are a lot of these cards are expensive. There's a lot of Mythics flying around, and, you know, Jesse at FNM has been playing his Den Collector list for 3 weeks. He's probably not switching over to Esper Dragons anytime soon, or it's going to take him a while, you know, something like that. So, like, that kind of stuff is actually probably more important for you if you're looking to win in local tournaments. Also, I don't know why I picked Jesse, this damn Bant deck.
I like Jesse because it could be either gender.
Sure, we'll go with that.
All right.
Also, there was Atlantic City, which Adam was.
America, Atlantic City.
Atlantic City, America's favorite playground. That was my fun fact that
I
found out.
It's like the Ghetto Vegas. That's all I know.
That's the actual slogan?
Ghetto Vegas. The slogan is also Do AC, you know, which is like, I guess, better than DC?
Like Slater?
It says
I don't know.
AC. That's literally the... That can't be the slogan.
It's also home to Miss America.
It's a talent contest.
It is.
So, very, very interesting town in some respects.
Sounds like something bad happened to Adam in Atlantic City.
No, I heard
it's interesting, full of dangers.
There are some dangers in Atlantic City. I mean, there's dangers in every city. Don't get me wrong there. But so that was Dragon's Tarkir Limited. So this was a sealed deck using 4 packs of Dragon's Tarkir, 2 packs of Fate Reforged into Dragon's Tarkir Fate Reforged Draft, 2 packs of Dragons, 1 pack of Fate. So basically, again, another mature format. It's been out for a while. It's been a Magic Online for feels like forever. The Pro Tour was like a month and a half ago. So people had a lot of familiarity already with the cards in the format. You know, obviously sealed is a little different from a draft, where you have a lot more control over what you're actually going to put into your deck in some respects. But just a really solid showing. Just some really great players pushed all the way in, made top eight. You know, Luis Scott Vargas added another top eight to his record as a Hall of Famer. Christian O'Connell and Alexander Hain made the finals. which is another great showdown. Gaudenus Vidigueras added a top eight again to his resume as well. Kind of somebody who's been a little off the radar perhaps recently. Still,
ever since his round one DQ at the Pro Tour, basically.
Yeah,
he had a weird interaction, and since then, I don't know if he's just been out of the game mentally or whatnot, but he just hasn't been.
Right. I think, as far as I know, he works a full-time job, and I know that that's a big strain on anyone that that wants to be a weekend Magic Warrior professionally. So it was just really great, really great finals until the game three. You know, Mana Screw happened to Alexander Haynes, so Calcano got to take home the win there. But the most of the games were really interesting. I watched Christian O'Connor's semifinal match, and he just kind of had some. He beat in the third game. He beat Sabretooth Outrider, basically runner, which is a very strong card for common in the set. Basically, it's a 4/2 first strike. Tom, if you're not familiar,
I may have been pulling that one up right now.
Yeah, it's basically a 4/2 first strike. So like, if you cast, if you have two of them up, you have, two 4/2 first strikers, just off of two creatures. It's a ton of first strike power attacking, a ton defensively. It's a really nice little setup. And so, Christian attacked into, his opponent, Brian Gottlieb, had one tapped, one he had just cast. And Christian Calcano attacked in with basically 2/2s, and Brian was at 6 life. So Brian just snaps, says, "No blocks." And so Calcano says, "Wait, I gotta think." This is before damage resolves, obviously. So Calcano's obviously telegraphing some sort of pump trick, and he's looking at two untapped rugged Highlands, Hinterlands. So basically, any combination of red, green, and mana are available for Brian. So Calcano's trying to remember, and he knows from playing the match next to him earlier, is that Brian has a Tarkus command. So obviously, being able to swing back with 2/4/4s plus a Tarkus command is 13 damage. That can just happen because you pump your creatures and then deal 3 damage to opponents as well. So, Calcano's trying to figure out, is it Twin Bolt, which he had seen earlier in the match, in his hand, or a Tarkus command, which would represent a lethal attack back on no block. And so Calcano decides to go for it at that point. Cast Butcher's Glee, which adds +3 power, and that's enough to be lethal for Brian as well. And Brian reveals a Tarkus command and another land in his hand. So it was a really, really tight semifinal. It was a lot of fun to watch. And his,
that one there is basically a coin flip. I mean,
yeah.
You have to figure out. I mean, I guess you also figure out what happens once your guy dies and you've been 2/1. Like, maybe you don't lose the game from there, but it sounds like he pretty much he wins or loses the game there based on the coin flip. Yeah, he knows his opponent has either of these cards. Like, maybe there's another card. Like, if there's a second Twin Bolt, of course, then that throws the equation off. But
yeah,
that's a fun spot at least.
Yeah, maybe this is a really good learning moment for me, Conley. So I was looking back. Obviously, I'm thinking about the situation. Like, I found it really interesting and exciting because, like, it's one of those things where it's like, it feels like a coin flip, but I also feel like it wasn't. Because if I have a 4/2 first strike and I have an instant speed removal spell in hand, like Twin Bolt, right? And I know I can kill either of the 2/2s that are attacking in. Basically, I'm giving up nothing by blocking, right? Because I can just respond to.
One of them was untapped, but I thought you said they were tapped.
One was tapped, one was untapped. He had an untapped
4/2. I didn't realize he actually had an opportunity to block.
Yeah, so he had a blocker.
Sure. So yeah, I wouldn't say that makes it definitive, but that certainly is some information you can use. Of course, then you could rationalize that maybe he's using that as a bluff, like, I don't block here because I need to get this 2/1 to win the game or whatever. So I mean, it's not exactly like that is enough information to really put me there. But I also don't know the person. Like, if Luis Scott Vargas is making that play against me versus random dude, I'm gonna just naturally weigh the situation differently, even if it's not warranted. So I mean, there's all kinds of factors that I think probably if you were a computer do actually add some value one way or another. But as a human, it is very hard to know actually which, you're going to have gut feelings and you're going to have to go with those. But it's really hard to know for sure if that is the correct play based off of data that you're actually processing or if it's just this is the feeling I have. And I think that using that gut feeling, using that subconscious thing is perfectly fine. I think oftentimes they do process information that we don't even understand how it's doing. So using that as a kind of guide is fine. But when it comes to like an intellectual decision you're making, a lot of times those things, it's like, even with some information, I'm still just flipping a coin. In this case, maybe it was a 55, 45 coin, but it's still, it's really hard for you to come to terms in your head to go, yeah, I am flipping a coin here, but I have a slight edge. You're still kind of at the end of the day going, all right, I'll play this bump spell, and like turning your head and hoping nothing happens. What, you had your hand up, Tom. What was it?
I'll say I could be the random dude.
Oh, sure.
With the 4-2 there.
That's fair. Yeah, in that case, then you guys kill your own guy.
What does that card do? Oh, let me kind of touch it.
Yeah, it does sound like an interesting situation, and it's one of those situations where both players probably tell a story about that for like the rest of their careers, one way or another. But if they don't actually ever discuss it together, I'm sure the stories are kind of different from like one person telling them, like, yeah, I was trying to represent by not blocking, by doing this and blah, blah, blah. You know, because technically blocking the 4-2 on the 2-2 is just a good, like, if he has +3/+0 like he had, or if he has +2/+2, which is tread upon, like either of those scenarios, the 4-2 still wins. So like theoretically the block is good regardless of whether he had a trick or not. He still didn't block. So like, you know, maybe he was like, he tells his buddies, yeah, I was trying to outplay him by not blocking and tricking him or whatever. And Calcano's like, well, I already knew that he didn't block, so therefore he didn't have a trick. Like they could literally both think that they made the correct play here and you know, go home. And I don't know. Magic's kind of interesting like that.
Yeah. I mean, again, that's why it's really stood out to me, and I found it fascinating just to kind of like look back and think about, and like, you know, I'm looking at the level zero of like, there's no harm in blocking here, and like the level, well, the level that you don't block, and then it represents something totally different. So it's, yeah, I don't know. Maybe someday I will.
So, I mean, any other interesting, like, I guess it was, like you said, limited, but any other interesting interactions or kind of key plays that stood out to you, Adam, doing coverage?
No, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, limited is exciting in different ways. Like, the cards are a little less exciting than the plays. Like, Luis Scott Vargas had a really great blue-black deck in his second draft.
Really great. With a bit of a high curve, I would say. First of all, his first deck had...
Asterisk, some values of really great.
It had 4 Avon Surveyors in it. I'm like, oh, okay, that's not that bad. And I look at his deck, and it had 5 other 5-drops. He had like 9 5-drops in the deck. I'm like, what the hell? He literally, on the picture he took on Twitter, he had an Avon Surveyor laid on all of his, like, his 1-drops, his 2-drops, his 3-drops, and his 4-drops, just so it didn't look like he had that many 5-drops. I'm like, come on, Luis, what are you doing? But yeah, his second deck...
Well, I think that was his first draft deck.
Yeah, yeah, the Avon Surveyor was the first draft deck.
Right. The second one, he had the blue black dragon that whenever you sack something, the opponent has to sack something, and so there's a situation where like he was climbing back into a game, and he used Sidisi, sacked Sidisi to itself to go get Sidisi's faithful, exploit it to itself, and stack the triggers to basically like remove everything on the opponent's side and attack for lethal all in a turn, which is just like, you know, feels like it comes out of nowhere, but like that's the kind of like the being able to stack the triggers because he controlled both properly between the Sidisi's faithful exploit and the trigger from Ruthless Deathfang. That's the dragon, Ruthless Deathfang. You know, it's just one of those little things. Like if you don't know that you can stack them the right way, and you just automatically do them in like the less correct order, you don't know that you can try to choose which one so you can bounce like the worst creature and force them to sacrifice the better creature. Like little things like that add up, and like Luis took advantage of that with his decks both rounds, really. But it was just like one of those plays under the camera that jumped out.
Now, are there any big Grand Prix coming before the enormous Vegas Grand Prix?
Yeah, there's 2 more this weekend. There is Team Sealed Florence, so get your 2 buddies and book a ticket to Italy now, because it's this weekend.
Get your little canoe.
And if that's not up your alley, there is another constructed tournament in Shanghai. So you can also take 2 buddies and go the opposite direction around the world from the United States and go play Magic as well. So it's another doubleheader weekend. There should be live video coverage from Florence, so I'm really excited to see that because, you know, I'm so used to seeing the U.S. teams. I've worked, you know, 2 or 3U.S. team Grand Prix now, and it's always interesting when you see different teams of you know, professional players and longtime veteran players teaming up that you wouldn't necessarily expect, because it's kind of like a confluence of like, hey, you know, we don't have teammates and let's work together, but like the apparent skill each one brings is also really high. So I'm kind of curious to see like what kind of like weird amalgam teams come together in Florence and kind of who rises to the top from that. Very famously, I think at Nashville, it was Luis Scott Vargas, Tom Martel, and Paulo Vitor Dama de Rosa that made it to the top four, I want to say. Nashville? Or was it the finals?
I don't think Tom Martel worked with Luis, did he?
No, it was...
Gian, Ifro, and Luis worked together.
Yeah, it was Nashville. Maybe it was the finals. It was Tom Martel, Paulo Vitor Dama de Rosa, and I can't remember the
I feel like I cannot remember this. That this was a tournament that those two teamed up. I'm gonna go investigate.
Right. Yeah. It's just like one of those things where you don't necessarily connect them like that, but like they came together and they had some great success. That was the one where Matt Nass and Jesse Hampton and again, I can't remember the third. It won. That was a really good showdown. I feel like an old man now. I can't even remember my old story straight.
What did you have for breakfast, Adam?
But I know it was Grand Prix Nashville.
Huevos Rancheros. And some coffee that tastes like filtered through a jock strap.
This morning, actually. I was very excited. Driving back from Atlantic City, we don't have like anything other than 7-Elevens where I live. So like Wawa's and Sheetz and these are all Northeast kind of restaurant built into gas station type deals. Like you can go in, you push like a screen and like you order food.
What? Like not from a person?
So
yeah.
I have never. This is high tech.
So Conley's got the people.
Did you get there in your self-driving car?
So it was Martel, Paulo, and Shar Shinrod.
Right.
And they lost. Yeah, they lost to Matt Nass and Hampton and Jacob Wilson.
Yeah. It's just like they're all great players, and you don't necessarily see them all working together like on a competitive team or a pro tours. Like it's great. So that's what I get excited about. So lots of magic happening this month.
In Vegas.
Yeah. Do you feel like this is too much like professional magic in one month, or are you just happy for as much as you can get?
If you go to it all, it's probably too much. But if you're like, you know, like me, for example, I haven't gone to anything yet, so I'm excited about Vegas. And if I'd gone to just, let's say, this past weekend in AC and then Vegas, I'd probably be okay. But yeah, if I was, you know, juicing it up and flying from Vegas to Shanghai or Florence and then back to, from Atlantic City to, well, I guess Atlantic City and Vegas are a good starting and ending points at least, but still.
They're a good bookends, yes.
Traveling that much when you spend like every waking hour on the road or whatever can get quite tiring. But I don't think there are too many players that like attended AC that are going to be going to Florence, and like there's probably 20 total or less that went to AC that will be going to either of the other two Grand Prix next weekend.
Yeah, and the geography and formats also are really disparate. So like Paris was this weekend, Florence was last weekend, Florence is this weekend, but like one was constructed, one is team limited. Extremely different formats, extremely different requirements coming in as a player. We had Grand Prix in, was it Sao Paulo?
Yeah, Brazil. Yeah.
And Toronto. So like basically opposite ends of you know, the hemisphere. And then Shanghai is all the way over in Asia. So like you're getting a lot of regional representation, a lot of format diversity. So like it isn't even overkill on any one particular, you know, format or group of players. Like you're really going to see different people at all these events, which I think is also really great.
Yeah, you see some of the same faces. Like, Juice is going to be at a Grand Prix every weekend. That's just what he does. But you don't know which Grand Prix. Like, he can't be in two of them at the same time, obviously. So still, like, Shanghai. Like, Juice is almost certainly going to be in Paris while they're doing something in Shanghai. Or Florence, excuse me, while they're doing something in Shanghai. So, like, you're still not going to see, you know, Juice competing with the likes of Tuhei, for example, who will probably be playing in Shanghai.
I feel like we've danced enough before we can talk about the big news of the week.
What's the big news?
A new set's coming out, guys. It's going to be expensive. It's called Modern Masters 2015.
I don't know if you can call that big news that the set's coming out, since that's been known for a long time.
The full spoiler. How about that?
No, there you go.
Funny man.
All right.
funny.
Also, the full spoiler came up about 4 days ago, and we were very slow and late.
Hey, we recorded today.
Yeah,
it's a Monday. I think it's cool. So let's just jump right into it. So Modern Masters, we have the entire spoiler, 249 cards that are just taking a dump on the speculative secondary market. So just try to guess. Adam's shaking his head. He completely disagrees with the stuff coming out of my mouth.
Okay, all right, so I want you to define taking a dump on the secondary market. Like,
change it.
Because
when somebody takes a dump on me, I usually change my clothes.
I'm challenging you right now to define that. What is it doing right now?
What, taking a number two?
Right, you're making a claim saying it is taking a dump. I'm challenging you to provide evidence for that claim.
I don't have it. I'm just talking to try to spawn conversation, as you may realize this, Adam.
So I'm going to talk conversation, but it's going to be like evidence-based observations and facts rather than just rampant speculation and broad statements that I can't back up. So one of the things that's great about Modern Masters, and basically, Tempest Remastered just released on Magic Online last week.
Jackass.
What's really great about these sets are rarity changes. So typically, different rares move around. So like in Tempest Remastered, cards like Rolling Thunder, which is like super fireball for all intents and purposes, got moved up to uncommon because, common super fireball is pretty good. Modern Masters, however, typically has the opposite direction happen. They had a lot of cards go from uncommon down to common, and even a rare go down to common, which obviously if you've, paid attention to me at all on any of the podcasts, anytime we talk about a set, I love commons. So I'm super excited for a whole bunch of new commons since they're commons now for the first time. Leader. Sorry, Conley?
Are you talking about Common Storm first?
No.
It's a myth.
Yeah.
But everyone's been upset about Common Storm being a mythic rare. I don't know if you've caught on to that.
Yeah.
But all right, continue with your comments. Sorry. I had to get my Common Storm meme out there.
I like Common Storm more than I like Ryusei.
That's fair. So.
I'd rather have one than the other. For example, pushed going down to common, Sign of the Wild is probably like the one that's been talked about the most because it was originally a rare, and it's one in green for basically an XX where its power is equal to the number of power and toughness are equal to the number of creatures you control. So if you have like a couple token makers, you play like a Dragon Fodder into this guy, you're going to have a 3-3, but if you have like Dragon Fodder into Whirling Outburst into this guy, again, using standard cards, those cards aren't in Modern Masters, but you would have like a 6-6 for 3 mana. So it has the potential to be really efficient and create a big body. It's very similar to an uncommon that was in Magic 2014, I believe it was a white uncommon, like Audrix Crusaders, that was like an XX where it was the number of creatures you control. So very similar power level, just now a common for the first time. A bunch of powerful uncommons, historically unlimited, even some constructed are now commons now, like Gutshot. Did not expect to see that as a common.
Yeah, they also moved a couple of. I'm looking. They moved a couple of commons up to uncommon. The thing you said that they don't really do, like Ethercast Knight, used to be a common in Shards, and now it's uncommon. And Pillory of the Sleepless was also. I guess it's because they're gold or whatever. Same for Scale Sigil Blessing, they're gold cards, so they needed to be uncommon to fill out the cycles. But they were all those cards were common at one point.
I think that's because they were all originally printed in multicolor sets, and now they're not. So. Yeah, and a lot of cards did move up in like Tempest Remastered, for example. So every time Wizards comes back and makes a new limited format from existing cards, they move the rarities around a little bit more to make the format work. They don't just strictly reprint a common as an uncommon if it doesn't make sense to do that. I think Sam Stoddard had a great article about kind of breaking down. It was almost like a guide, like if you were looking to build a cube. I'll have to find the link for you, Tom. It was like just laying out like, hey, these are the fundamentals of like what to consider if you're looking at building a limited set. And then basically, you talked about like filling in that it's not quite a paint by color, but by having like this like breakdown of like the things that you're looking for, you can begin to pull in the cards you know, common and uncommon that kind of fill out the base of like what makes a set feel acceptable for limited. It was a really cool article. I enjoyed it.
Looks like to fit follow up, you Sphere of the Suns got moved down to common, so that's a new one for Pauper, I would imagine.
That's a really nice card for Pauper.
And then I noticed Tumble Magnet and all the bounce lands got moved up to uncommon. Eldrazi Temple got moved down to uncommon. That's a big deal.
Yeah, you could apparently you're able to draft an Eldrazi deck, which is what I want to do.
There's some cards in the set that don't make a lot of sense to me, and I understand why they're here to a degree. For example, let's talk about Daybreak Cornet. Daybreak Cornet is the type of card that I feel like got thrown in at the last minute because they realized the price of it was too high, and they want to get some more copies to lower the price down because it's a $30 or $40 card. Because if you actually look at the rest of the set, there is exactly one benefit. So you have Goblin Warpaint that works with it. That's a common. You have Splinter Twin at rare that works with it, although you would never want to do that. And then you have Arrest, Pillory of the Sleepless, and some other, I don't remember what the other thing is, but you also put on your opponent's creature. Basically nothing that works with Daybreak Cornet for limited, and yet it's a rare, not a mythic, which means it's going to show up a decent amount of the time, and your basement is not going to be able to play it unless you happen to have like three or four Goblin Warpaints. And I don't know, while I can understand them wanting to get that kind of price down on that card, it seems like if you're going to include that in the set, put a little bit of support, like fit a couple of auras in white or whatever, just to make it, you know, something that the player could do if they want. You basically cannot do that at all right now. There's a couple of other cards that are really, really weird as well that were printed at rare that do not need price reductions at all, that could have probably been printed in uncommon considering they were going through these wild shifts in rarity. Like, there's some really bad cards, like Inexorable Tide got reprinted. Like, that card is, just look one card down, Novigen Sages, that's how it's pronounced. That card used to be a rare as well, got moved down to uncommon. Pretty complex card, drawing you multiple cards, has graft, whatever. Inexorable Tide, I would say, is about the same complexity level, and yet they kept that at rare. Even though it's not really a valuable card, no one's looking for it to change in market value. So it's kind of weird that they would take up a slot for that type of effect, especially at rare when like that's a kind of a build around card that having it on combo would be pretty interesting. Same for like Surikar Spellblade. That's kind of a weird one. That one actually might be a casual one. I don't know. I doubt it, but maybe it is. If you know, Adam, if Surikar Spellblade is a casual card.
Not really. Doesn't really have any like internal evasion, so it's kind of difficult to.
Oh, Endred Star. That's another one that I looked up that was like 2 cents. I was like, oh, maybe that one sees play in EDH. And it's like 2 cents, and it
does, but it's been reprinted in like I think all of the Commander releases so far.
Yeah, that's fair.
And another deck. So like this is, you know, this is one of those things where it's like, so people sometimes reminisce about like the old core sets in kind of like a nostalgic way, like, oh, Wizards should just have like these sets where like, you know, oh, it's great, let's just reprint these cards and get them into the format, you know, as if it's, like, Wizard's job to make, like, a little, like, standard box set. To, like, here's, you know, here's four decks in here, you know, four of all these Mythic Rares that you need. But this is, like, one of the reasons that, like, reprint sets have really, you know, went away with Magic 2010, is that it's really hard, because you have these competing values. Like, Modern Masters wants to help provide gateways for players to the format, like the ability to acquire new copies or other copies of cards that are prominent place in decks like Splinter Twin and things like that that have been out of print for years now, and yet they still have to create like a limited format that works. So like Daybreak Cornet is absolutely like one of those really wild cards from Future Sight that's just absurdly expensive, and you really want it for your Hexproof deck. But they did make it internally consistent for the limited environment, and it just sticks out like a sore thumb. So, like, those things that just come up with reprint sets, like, you know, I think that this is the first, I don't want to say the original Modern Masters printing was better, but I think that more of these sore thumbs are visible kind of this time around.
Yeah,
there's also things conspicuously missing, like somebody's like, hey, what about Serum Visions? You know, that, like, the only common, like, one of the desperately needed common draw spells that are also critical to, like, Splinter Twin and combo decks. It's, like, a $5 common from, you know, Fifth Dawn or whatever. And basically, you know, Mark Rosewater posted on his blog, like, Scry is not a mechanic in Modern Masters.
Which is just stupid because we have steady progress, telling time, Tezzeret's Gambit, and Thoughtcast that I can literally look at all in the spoiler without mousing a page down. There are four draw spells I just named that all have like some other effect on them. You could have replaced almost any of them with that card, and it would not have changed the set in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, so it's it may be one of those things where it's like, you know, there are some lessons that'll play into the next Modern Masters release. I think it's a little maybe early to tell that, but it certainly feels that way from like prevailing opinion.
Just looking at this set, I have to say that the first Modern Masters just looked better, more well built, like in terms of both how it played in limited and how it was constructed for the secondary market. Obviously, it did not have the same effects that they expected on the secondary market, or at least that we expected. But we also know that now. And we know that things at Mythic Rare are not going to drop in price, basically. There's not enough of them. Things at Rare can drop in price if done correctly and released in enough product. But things at Uncommon and Common are almost certainly going to drop in price. So, I don't know. The fact that they had that information and a lot of these cards kind of didn't go down, it's a little weird. But that said, like, the set does look awesome. I was looking at some more of the Commons that you were talking about, Adam. Vile Sheen or Slaughtermaster seems like a pretty sweet card in Pauper. That's now common, I noticed.
Yeah, I mean it's triple color. It's it's one of those things where like because it costs one color to play, it's basically a first strike in Grey Ogre. Otherwise, right?
No, it's just a 2-mana double strike. It always has double strike. Yeah. 2-mana.
Oh, it always has double strike, right?
And then it gets +1/+1 if for black green, but you don't have to be playing black green.
Yeah.
But yeah, like anything with double strike on it in Pauper just feels like it can be abused because that's one of the formats where you just slide something through and then pump it four times and it's game over.
Yeah, I might give Telling Time a try. I used to do Impulse. Like I feel like they're pretty comparable. Like I feel like Impulse sees more cards, but Telling Time gives you a little more control, which is probably fine in 40 card. Like I feel they're pretty comparable. I just haven't had that effect in the cube for a while, so I might experiment and add that in to see how people like that over the things like Enhanced Awareness and kind of the other card draw that's Instant Speed that's pretty good at Common.
The draw card Proliferate. I think there's Telling Time, Steady Progress, they're both instants, and then Tezzeret's Gambit and Thoughtcast for sorceries.
Right. Yeah, Telling Time is an instant, and it's common now for the first time. I'm also a big fan of Cathodine and Sickle Slicer. So Cathodine's a 3/3 for 3 that's colorless, which is really nice. So it just gives any deck like blue-black control and things like that, a nice a creature that's basically bigger than the curve.
He used to come with a drawback some amount of the time. But now it doesn't.
Yeah, Suchi.
And when they did away with Mana Burn, it was suddenly all upside. And it's one of the blue and black have a lot of ways, and red as well have a lot of ways to use just random 3-mana that pops up in the middle of combat. And Sickle Slicer is really nice because it's basically a morph that turns into a pretty sizable equipment. Like +2/+2 is big game, and at least in my Pauper cube. And so the 4-mana to equip is pretty expensive, but late in the game, it's one of those ways that spending 4-mana and being able to do something else on a turn in my Pauper cube isn't that hard as the game goes on. So being able to have like a 2/2 for 3 on turn 3 and equip something on turn 6 is totally reasonable. Sickle Slicer is a living weapon.
Yeah, it's a living weapon. Yeah,
a living weapon that gives +2/+2. Yeah, the commons are just nice overall too.
All I want to do is cast Clockworm. That's all I want to do. Will you let me do that, Adam? Please.
Yeah, cast Clockworm. I love casting Clockworm in Erklug's Uncommon Cube. And that card brings...
Clockworm is like one of my favorite cards to cast ever. I don't know, you just feel so good. You're just like, yeah, kill it. I don't care. I got my 7 life and I got my card back. I don't care. Kill it. It just feels so good. But yeah, there's a... I don't know. The limited format does look like it has some sweet things. Like, I'm a big fan of Domain, and there's a couple of Domain cards and some things that don't necessarily have Domain, but but work with five color strategies like All Sun's Dawn and Edge and Sunburst and stuff like that. So, I mean, there is some cool limited things that are definitely going to be fun to play with. The set almost will certainly be a blast to play with. But in general, I would say I'm so far a fan of The Last Modern Masters a little bit more. But, you know, there are lessons to be learned. Hopefully they do. So I am happy that one of my favorite cards ever got reprinted, Necroskitter. That is, I love that card to death. We're friends. We're best friends.
Speaking of Domain Conley, Dragon Soul Knight.
Yeah, that's a common now.
It's a common now.
Yeah. That was in my first ever Pro Tour top eight. I had one of those. It was a limited format, by the way. Everybody that's right now looking at what constructors can play.
All right, so for Adam Conley, when can we expect to actually be playing with some Modern Masters 2015?
When?
It releases next Friday, May 22nd. So if you haven't pre-ordered, with an online retailer or with your local store, you should get on it. You know, there's definitely more availability than before. But obviously everybody is looking for as much as they can, given kind of like the insanity that happened last time. So I think there's still time to get in on, especially if you want a box that's, the box is basically exactly... any player draft without any price support. So if you've got a couple buddies and you all go in on a box and have a draft, or like you buy a box and have like a, you know, game night and just like, okay, everybody, let's open the packs for me, but let's do it in a draft and play. And then I keep the cards at the end. You know, it's, I know that's what a lot of guys that I'm going to be playing with are going to be looking to do. So, it's going to be sweet.
So are you guys
on Magic Online a day early?
Yep.
Cause there's complaint. Is that what you're about to bring up?
Yeah, a little bit of that too. And then also I don't know if you guys got the big release about the big Modern Masters weekend where they're trying to make this huge event. And
I mean, that's the Vegas, right? I assume.
Well, it's let's talk about that a little bit.
It's a little more international.
The Magic Online piece.
Oh, the Magic Online one. Okay.
Go for it. I don't play that thing.
You have the webpage right in front of you. At least give us the information.
I've got the email, but it's more talking about the paper version.
Which is it talking about GP Vegas? Is that
what it's Vegas, about? Chiba, Japan, and Utrecht, Netherlands.
Yeah, they had them all. I mean, for us in America, it's GP Vegas, but other places are also doing it.
They want to have expected to draw over 20,000 players.
Is that a WOTC email or a Channel Fireball?
This is official WOTC email.
Oh, okay.
This is the press release we're talking about?
This is the press release. This got it today.
Yeah. So Vegas obviously is a big thing in the States, and we're all talking about, like, if you play Magic competitively, even remotely at your local store, you've heard about this event. So, it's probably going to, I think AK is a pretty reasonable estimate for where it could be. If it happens to cap out at 10, I would be stunned. Delighted for Magic, but stunned just as much. But what's happening on the coverage side that they were talking about in that press release, Tom, is basically 24 hours continuous streaming coverage.
Really?
From these events. So it'll start in Utrecht, it'll go over Las Vegas, and then it'll hit Chiba and loop around to the other Grand Prix again. And so between the three of them, there will be continuous live coverage from the events.
So,
any time of day, anywhere you are in the world, you will be able to get a glimpse at and share in the experience of Modern Masters 2015 edition. That's kind of the thrust.
But will they be broadcasting the four couples who will tie the knot during the weekend?
I don't know. That blows my mind. Like, I had an awesome wedding and it was a great time. And, you know, it's like everybody has their own thing, I guess. But it's like I would not want to do my wedding at a Magic event. Like I really like doing my wedding and like the safety of like I can stumble around my hotel.
Wait, they put that in the press release?
Absolutely. I'll give you the direct quote. So it kind of leads in. It says, a testament to the passionate global Magic the Gathering community. Round the clock coverage will highlight some truly amazing player stories, including four couples who will tie the knot during the weekend.
I have played this game professionally for, 8 years, 7 years, and played Magic for 11 or so, and I would never consider ever getting married in any type of Magic event or on any type of Twitch coverage unless I was like being paid a lot of money to do so.
I thought it was
interesting. I assume that's not the case.
I imagine you have your wedding cake, you turn around, you turn back, and the cake is just gone because it's a Grand Prix with like 50,000 people there.
It's just a strange. If I'm there, like, and I see these people, I'm obviously going to congratulate them and be happy for them or whatever. But I could not ever imagine that being a joyful experience. Like, I don't know. I would personally want it to be more private than that. But
yeah, and the thing is like I totally get it. Like I know it's not for me, but like for people that I met through magic, and like magic is just such like a big part of their life. You know, like I can see doing that. I mean, just some people, that's what they enjoy, is like that sort of like festival atmosphere where it's like, you know, I'm going to have like some of my family members and a bunch of them might play magic, a bunch of my friends that are there too. And then there's all these other strangers that are just like excited to be in the same place as well. Like, yeah, there's a lot of feel good there too.
How do you explain it to grandma though?
She's in front of the slot machine, Tom. She's fine.
That's true. It is Vegas. I guess being married in Vegas already kind of has its own thing.
She's like, where are the strippers at? Oh, Grandma, you embarrass me. But you're also awesome.
If you tell somebody you're getting married at a magic event in Vegas, they think very different things than what you're talking about. That's all I can say. They're like looking for a Chris Angel and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's like we used to do the old live Monday Night Magics. Every once in a while, we had the guy call in asking us about how they do certain magic tricks.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yes.
The one thing I'm waiting to have happen at some point. I'm such a cynic and you know, kind of a cynical type person. You know, if you'll want to take it that way. But I'm waiting for like somebody to make like, let's say, top eight of like a pro tour, right? Or they're at a pro tour and like they bring their girlfriend and they decide to like, they want to propose like in the event, or like propose on stage when they go up for a feature match or something like that. Or like at a Grand Prix, you know, they'll come up and try to propose. Like I'm waiting for that type of thing to happen at a Grand Prix. Like, I think I've seen a proposal at a Grand Prix where a judge asked for, you know, basically the one player, and then the other was like there to ask them from like the judge podium, or like the main stage. Like, I think I saw that one time. Like, I'm waiting for that to happen, but like for it to be like the no. You know, like, you've seen this at, like, you've seen, like, the YouTube videos of, like, baseball parks and stuff like that, where, like, somebody does the proposal in the park and, like, gets turned down. Like, that brutality, I'm waiting to have happen at a magic event, and it's going to be the worst. Like, it's just going to be terrible to witness, but, like, it's going to happen at some point.
You're wishing bad things upon our community right now.
So. I said I was cynical! Come on!
That doesn't mean it's okay to just blatantly just...
Hope for misery, like public humiliation.
I said I'm anticipating it happening at some point in my career of being a participant or contractor on at premier level magic events. That's what I'm saying.
Would it bring it up a notch, kind of, though, if when that happened, if it's a Modern Masters 2015 draft and I yell gut shot, would that bring it up a little bit?
Only if you simultaneously then play some Bon Jovi.
And you're too. It just flipped the gut shot out.
Yes.
And jump up on the table, karaoke style.
That's what happened for Worlds 2011. That was our... We often developed theme songs based off of card names, and basically everyone had that song programmed in their phone, and whenever it got out, we played it constructed, somebody would pull out their phone and start playing it. It's the literal real-life meme. That's what testing on a team is like. There's just real-life memes that develop, and then you just go with it.
It's in-jokes. It is in-jokes, and it's magic.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Any other big stories for the week or last couple of weeks?
I mean, there was a documentary on magic.
Yeah, I guess I had back on to watch it.
Documentaries.
Yeah, it was because it was on.
Well, I say that because it really wasn't on magic as a whole, and it really was. It's very short, so like it's a cool piece on magic, but I wouldn't even necessarily call it like a doc. It's not going to meet your expectations. When if somebody just told me there's a documentary on magic, I would expect like an hour and a half film or something. It's not like that.
Is this like an interest piece maybe about magic?
It is a focus piece on Jacob Wilson, who he happened to top eight the pro tour that they were following him at. It was kind of like a spur of the moment thing that happened. All the stars kind of collide, and they ended up with this awesome piece about, like, I don't know, his sacrifices in magic and like where he was at and kind of like his perspective on the game and things like that. It's pretty interesting. Adam can talk about it more, but it was kind of how it played out. Like, they basically went into it like looking to follow Jacob, and then a bunch of cool stuff happened, and then they got a cool movie out of it.
Yeah, and it wasn't just on Jacob Wilson. It also it basically kind of split almost almost evenly kind of between Jacob Wilson and these guys that just have been playing Magic since the beginning. They still play Vintage in New York City, and kind of talking about like their perspective of the game, like what keeps them going. Cause they're like, they look like dads, you know, like middle-aged guys, because that's what they are. You know, they picked up the game in their late teens or early 20s, and it's been 20 years, so, like, there's a generational thing happening. And that was kind of like the end cap at the end of the videos. They had these two kids at the Pro Tour playing each other and kind of just taught their banter, talking back and forth, you know, kind of, like, showing, like, the, you know, obviously a very symbolic full circle of, like, people start as kids, they grow up, become adults, and then their kids start, you know, kind of in their wake. And it was, you know, used the clip from like Brian Dave and Marshall when Jacob Wilson was in the finals of Pro Tour Born of the Gods, saying if Jacob had won at the age of 18, he would have been the first player to win a Pro Tour, but yet be younger than the game. So that's kind of like one of the things that's still hanging out there. I think Shahar Shanhar's won a world championship being younger than the game, if I remember the dates correctly.
I think he was like 19 or 20 at the time, and it was about, maybe it was younger, I'm not sure.
It was very close, one way or another. But that's not considered, but a world championship is not a Pro Tour, so like specifically Pro Tour winners themselves. It was kind of what Brian was quoting. So it's, you know, it's, you know, I thought it was neat in that, it's not that it didn't go out of its way to put Magic in a positive light, but I also feel it didn't like dispel any preconceptions people would have about Magic. You know, it definitely like drove home, like there are people that are just, you know, really, really into the game. Just like, you know, like if you look at Legos, right? Like look up YouTube Legos, YouTube videos of Lego builders and like Lego channels. And it's like, you're really similar to Magic, where it's just clearly these guys that are super passionate about, you know, whatever their hobby is.
You can say kind of like, white, older males. You can just say it.
Well, not always, actually. But you know, it was it was a very well done piece. You know, I just kind of wish it had. I wish it had explored a little bit more of like why the culture is how it is, rather than just kind of like the experience that's happening in the culture today, and kind of what that means generationally.
That's kind of what I took away. It's like, it was a cool thing to check out, and it was even something that, like, I would not be embarrassed for somebody who did not know Magic to watch it as, like, you know, something like that, where there are plenty of documentaries I've seen that I would be embarrassed. I'm like, this does not represent our game in any way. But at the same time, it's not the full picture. It doesn't give a lot of the information that I would also want to provide. Like, if somebody watched this video and then had me there to answer some questions or whatever, I would feel way more comfortable than them watching this video and then walking away and that's their take on Magic. Because while it doesn't shed the game, shed negativity on the game, it doesn't necessarily give people all the information they need or kind of talk about some of the niche things that really make the game what it is. And because of that, I don't really consider like a full-fledged documentary. I feel it's a really cool piece, and I appreciate that it was done, but it's not like one of those things where it's like, yeah, point people to this and then they'll learn about Magic and they'll be caught up to speed and ready to go. I'm so glad it exists, so that's cool.
There's only one thing that jumped out at me as, and this is totally like an editorial nitpick and probably like nitpicky of nitpicky, is at the end, you know, they talked about, after the Pro Tour, Jacob Wilson, Pro Tour Fate Reforged, where he made top eight, he went on to win a Star City Invitational. And, basically at NCAP, you know, kind of like the resolution was, you know, he got they printed in text on the screen and he was immortalized, on a card. And I really wanted just card to be token instead, because it's not a Magic card. It was a token he was immortalized on, which is very, very subtle and totally nitpicky and totally unreasonable, I think, to be nitpicky about. But it's like the only thing that jumped out at me is like, I really wish I would, you know, if I was an editor that had seen it in pre-production,
the thing is, even if they knew that, like, let's say they very easily could have made that decision consciously, because the general audience does not have any idea what a token is, and they know what a card is. So,
yeah, and that's why I'm saying it's probably unreasonable to be nitpicky about it. But it was like the only thing that like jumped out at me is like that I didn't like about the video. So that's saying a lot for it. Like I'm being like ultra nitpicky, and it's not even like a legitimate nitpick, and I admit that. So take that for what it is.
What?
I think that's it.
We got some emails, so.
Oh, that's what you can do. Go, Tom.
Emails. We have a handful, actually, if we want to share them up.
Well, I don't know what you mean by that, but...
Are any of them urgent, Tom? Do you want to maybe do a mailbag episode?
We could. I mean, because we have one that's actually a question for Conley. It's a direct question for Conley. So that's why I kind of want to at least share this one. Yeah, yeah. Drop the floor. This is from Kai T. Says, last cast, Conley, you mentioned that when you build a deck for a pro tour or whatever large event, you build the deck more for the event as opposed to just building a generically good deck. Can you comment on the Spidey senses? That's a Paul Blart Mall Cop. Spidey senses. And or tools you use to gauge a meta enough to be able to do this before heading into it. And he's like, is this playing local events? Is this articles, buzz on the internet, MTGO, secret pro insider knowledge? Lucky guess?
So it is, I guess, a combination of all those things. You're basically looking to take your meta knowledge. When I say meta, I don't mean of the metagame. I mean your compiled knowledge of everything and are looking to make educated guesses, use data to your advantage, whatever. So, like, if I'm testing for a pro tour, one of the goals of that testing is not necessarily, I mean, it is always to find the best deck, but to get to finding the best deck, you figure out the metagame. So you figure out what all the good decks are, then you figure out what beats those decks, and that's theoretically what the best deck is. But unless you know what the good decks are, you don't know what deck beats them, and you don't know what the good decks are unless you play the good decks against the bad decks, and they beat the bad decks. So in order to find out what the best deck is, you end up basically having to create the entire metagame.
But how many decks could a bad deck beat if a bad deck could beat good decks?
Sure. and so you end up creating this thing where you have a large scope of decks in your gauntlet where you've had to create these decks to get to what the best deck is. And then let's say I then picked the best deck. I now get to use my knowledge of all those other decks. Go, well, I know Mono Red's going to be popular because it was beating up on this, this, and this, but it doesn't necessarily beat Rug. Rug also beats those decks, so I'm going to put Rug as another popular deck. And then you're kind of tiering off decks and figuring out where they exist, and then also looking at what weaknesses your deck has against those specific decks. So, like, if my deck that I choose has no weaknesses against Rug and Mono Red, it doesn't matter if they're the second and third best decks. I'm going to basically dedicate very little in my sideboard to that, or I'm going to put less concern in my main deck to those decks because I already have naturally good matchups. So I'm just doing things like crunching numbers, figuring out specific matchups, using knowledge that, you know, of the decks that exist in the metagame, both from articles, from MTGO, from my own gauntlet creations, from ideas of other pros, of course. And you're kind of like compiling all of that and then putting it into a bit of a machine and cranking out an idea. And the thing is, you're wrong a lot of the time. As a deck builder, at least, and you know, when you're wrong, you're generally not wrong by a lot, but it doesn't matter. If you're wrong about two decks in the metagame, like, that can be a big deal. Like, if I build a deck to beat decks number two and three, and decks number two and three end up being decks number five and six, I showed up with a bad deck. Like, it doesn't matter if those two decks still showed up. But yeah, that's a really hard question to answer, just because unless you kind of built a deck for a pro tour or built a deck for a Grand Prix and been in that environment where you're like figuring out everything and writing down numbers, and it, you know, it's a multiple week process, so it's really hard to kind of sum it up as, you know, this is what I do, but it's basically a combination of literally everything you listed. So
all right, so do I get to share my one last email, Adam?
Or do you want to read it? We've already started. No, go ahead.
Okay, it's actually, it has a little bit for you too there, Adam, so I'm trying to share the love a little bit. This is from Eric W. It says, aloha, host of MTG Potpourri. Your last episode was, and I say this without a hyperbole, the greatest episode of not only the history of this podcast, but podcasting in general. I would have never imagined hearing about veterinary sleep medicine seminars, crappy mystery stories, and Conley's, sorry, it's an air quote, dancing in a magic podcast ever. There's an issue that I would like some advice. After years of kitchen table and Commander Magic, I recently took the plunge and started playing competitive Standard online. This past week, though, I've been on a huge losing streak. The majority of those losses coming from genuine bad luck, like Mana Screw, Mana Flood, Mulliganing to 5. This is frustrating me not only because I don't feel like I'm learning how to improve my game, but also because I'm used to find the variants of Magic the most enjoyable part. Combined with losing tickets to enable me to keep playing in the, I'm assuming, the events, I'm beginning to feel discouraged from planning any more of the sweet Standard format. And there is a link. It's a YouTube link. He says, P.S. the link is safe. It just leads to what I think Dancer Conley Woods looks like. I'll share it with you. Don't worry.
I'm sure.
So I'll let you take first crack, Conley, and then I'll add anything if I really...
I'm not going to say much on the subject. I'm just going to say the first thing to do to improve is to stop the mentality that you just... Like, basically, to ever suggest that the reason you're losing is variance is a bad attitude to have, because you cannot control variance by nature, by definition. It is a random bit of element that comes with the game. So for you to put any amount of energy, any amount of fixation, any amount of mental... anything, any amount of time into thinking about, caring about, or looking to alter variance in some way is useless. If instead you focus on all the things you can do to improve your game, maybe put some more lands in your deck, maybe work on your shuffling. Some people literally shuffle so poorly that they do not shuffle their lands properly and have a chance of clumping and drawing all lands or no lands. Like, that's the thing that some people do. They just suck at shuffling that bad. So maybe look at that.
Breeze on MTGO.
If it's on MTGO, then you just add more lands to your deck. Do whatever you need to do. Start playing different decks. Play an Esper deck that has 28 lands and a million draw spells and things you can't flood out. You literally just can't, or whatever. There are different directions to go to take the game where variance should just not be a thing because you can't control it. Like, imagine walking around going, well, what if, like, imagine walking around worrying about every possible way you could ever die. Like, you would just never do anything. You would just sit. You would never cross the street. You would never go outside. You would, like, you just cannot possibly worry about that kind of stuff because it's variance. It's randomness. You would literally be weighed down by it, and you would not be able to focus on things and be productive with your life. The exact same thing happens for Magic. If you're focusing on that random element you have no control over, you're just never going to improve the things you need to. You're never going to improve your deck building skills. You're never going to learn when to scry away a land or when to keep the Ugin on top when you only have two mana and it's correct, or which hands to keep in certain matchups. There's just so many. Magic has literally infinite things to learn that you will never master the game, and there are so many things to focus on that focusing on the one thing you can't control is just the worst. Focus on everything else, and you'll get better.
Just kind of add to that, the one thing that I really helped me turn my limited game, because I used to really dwell on the I got mana flooded, or I got mana screwed, or I just didn't draw what I needed to draw, and it's all it went beyond the mentality, because it was affecting my, I was completely ignoring my ability to make better decisions in game. I was actually overshadowing the fact that just this past week, like, I won more games of limited off of Mulligans to five than I did off of, the one hand I got to keep at seven. And it's because I focused on making every individual decision the best that it possibly could be. And I'm not saying I can make that yet. I'm still learning that, and I don't think any player can play perfectly perfect 100% of the time. It's just impossible. But I've really focused on asking questions of the players that I feel are more skillful, getting insight for players that play the game differently from me, and kind of trying to understand, what am I really looking for every turn of the game? What are the things that my opponent is looking for? And kind of that level zero is pretty much where I'm at. I'm trying to move my way up a little bit, and it's just, I focus on what do I do in this situation? It doesn't matter if I have three lands in hand and five in play and only two creatures and, like, I'm backs against the wall. What is the best block I can make here? Or do I block? Or do I, if I've got a Tygem Strike in hand, do I try to turn this into a race? And why would what does that mean for what I would draw next? Just trying to always set up how do I win this game from where I'm at? And it's a big shift from dwelling on the negatives of it, and I found that it's helped me win more games because I'm focused on winning rather than why am I, things that are uncontrollable about my losses.
I mean, maybe in even a little more generic, it sounds like he's playing in, like, events, queues, things like that. Would you ever recommend playing more like in a tournament practice room? Do you think there's other ways that'd be valuable ways to get experience?
It has nothing to do with that. Like if you are a competent player, you can play in any Magic Online queue and be fine. It's not like you need to be in a specific thing. It's just you need to learn that you start improving your game, start focusing on things to improve, and stop focusing on the other stuff, and then start improving. Like, maybe you're going to lose a bunch, but that's the process you need to go through to start winning a bunch. That's just what happens. Like, complaining about it or giving up or whatever is not going to get you there. If you truly want to be better at Magic, you need to continue to work at it, and you just need to ignore the things that you can't control, work on the things you can. It's really that simple. Like, I know I keep repeating it, but that is a broad thing to say as well, so I can't say it's that simple because I just said it in five words, but it is actually a giant concept. But in reality, it's just, you know, there are – Magic is an immersive game. There are a lot of factors to it, and you will never be perfect at it. So start with whatever you're bad at. Start improving. There, you know, be honest with yourself. That's the thing is a lot of players are not honest with themselves. They say they lost to that mulligan to five, or they made that third land drop incorrectly, or, you know, or didn't make it or whatever. And it's like, well, in reality, you misblocked here. You gave up a 2-for-1 here that could have caught you back up and made your mold of five into mold of six all of a sudden. You know, played this card when you should have played this other card, and it lost you this. Like, there are so many small factors that you just, if you just blindside yourself and go, well, I had a mold of five, that was that. Like, you just learn nothing about the game. Like Adam's saying, like, the reason, one of the reasons that good players win more games is because they keep themselves in positions to win a game longer. Like, if I'm at a mold of five and on the back foot the whole time, but I'm making proper blocks, keeping as many relevant creatures as I can alive, setting myself up to top deck the three runner pump spells I need to win the game, I'm still going to win that game, you know, 1 out of 20 times, whereas the player who conceded effectively on turn three because he missed his third land draw is never going to have a chance to win that game. So, like, those things add up over time, and you just start to win more and more games of Magic just because you're focusing on things you can actually do control the outcome of the game.
One of the side effects of focusing on things that you can control is you can begin to identify errors that you didn't notice before. So I was in a game where I had Ojutai Summons, Taigum Strike, a face down Stratus Dancer, and Conley helped me here. Not Shamanistic Revelation, the 5-mana draw card for each creature you control.
It's gain. It's gain 4 life for each creature, and then draw a card
with Ferocious, and then draw a card for each creature. And so I was in a position where I could have drawn 3 cards and basically not really had an effective attack. And my opponent was well ahead on board. Much bigger creatures. I think it was like a combination of Dragon Scale Elite or Dragon Scale General with the 1-mana tap bolster and gives it vigilance. So it was just like he was just going off making bigger and bigger creatures to hit me with every turn. And instead of at 6-mana, I could either draw 3 cards and basically do nothing else that turn effectively, or I could have Taigum Struck and left up 2-mana for my Stratus Dancer to counter a pump spell or a removal spell. So I drew 3 cards instead, and immediately after I drew those 3 cards, I realized I should have tried to go for the race, because the next turn I would have been able to draw 3 cards and then maybe had 2-mana up for a removal spell or a bounce spell or something else instead, and it would have put me in a different position.
You probably would have gained
I would have gained 4 life, which was incredibly relevant if I'm setting up to race at that point. As soon as I saw it, it was obviously too late. And right at the end of the match, you know, I asked Alex Mazeltan, you know, hey, you know, did you notice anything funny? And that was the thing. He's like, yeah, the only thing I really noticed was exactly that. So when you double down and you move your mindset away from what Conley was saying, those things that you're not in control of, and just focus on the things that you are, you're going to naturally find those little points of things of where you are going wrong, because you're looking for things you control. And that's really kind of the root lesson of that.
Also, if you want to control those things, like Mana Screw or whatever, become a game designer and design your own game that doesn't have Mana Screw in it and works perfectly.
Here's a hint. It won't be as good as Magic.
It's called Pokemon.
There's a reason Mana Screw exists. It's because it secretly makes the game great and you don't know it. It's true. It's just the truth.
Well, guys, we love getting emails, and girls, and whoever else out there that listens. Aliens, dolphins, whoever's listened to this podcast. It's mtgpopery@gatheringmagic.com. Conley, where can people find you, email you, send you decks to fix, everything else?
They send decks to fix via at Twitter, so I can mention that one. So that's at Conley81. Actually, Deck Doctor just went up, so go check that out. I did a bunch of matches, like 6 matches, including a standard 8-man with a mono blacklist that I think is very strong and standard if you're looking for something different but competitive. At Conley81 for Deck Doctor, use hashtag Deck Doctor in there. That way I can check out your deck without
with an E.
I can check out your deck while searching for it with a hashtag so I can find it easily in the future.
Freckles on the bottom. That's not standard, good.
Standard videos or standard decks only, please.
Those aren't freckles.
But yeah, that's a, and then you find my content on channelfireball.com. That's where Deck Doctor is, and then articles on tcgplayer.com. I just wrote one about that dragon reanimator list for TCG Player. I think it's pretty cool. It has Fearsome Awakening. If you ever Fearsome Awakening a Dromica, you got a 7/9 flying life link dude out there. It's pretty badass. Just saying.
All right, Anna, how about for you? Where can I check out your deck? What sort of websites, public bathrooms, truck stops would I be able to figure out? Get this.
You can check out my commander decks and actually many more commander decks from all across the commander community on dailyndg.com every Thursday. That's Command Tower, the official official commander article series on the official Magic the Gathering website. You can find me on gatheringmagic.com. I'm going to be trying to work on my Popper Cube update for Modern Masters 2015 edition. So many good new commons to look at. Really interesting directions that are making me rethink some of the archetypes in my cube even. So it's going to be a really interesting discussion. I think it's going to be more the principle and theory and why I've done the things I've done in my cube and what sets like Modern Masters can do to kind of change that. So if you're into cube and in theory and you want to yell at me and tell me how wrong I am, it's a great time to kind of follow along me there. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm the_Stibs, STYBS. You'll find me at many of the Grand Prix coming up this year. I'll be at Vegas. I'll be at Charlotte. I'll be at Providence. I will be at San Diego. I will be at Montreal. So if you're in North America and you're going to Grand Prix, the other they're very good. We'll cross paths, so don't be afraid to say hi. I will be running around like a madman, but I'll smile at you. It'll be good.
I'll be at some number of those, but I don't know which ones outside of Vegas thus far.
Yes, we will high five.
Yeah,
Tom, take us out.
You can find me here.
No, he means take us out at Vegas. You got to come to Vegas and take us out.
Oh, that would be fun, but I'm
what?
Taking care of kids is what I'll be doing. Man. Yeah, I'm going to be learning My Little Ponies.
The disease.
And not in a brony way. Like, I literally know My Little Ponies. Like, there's Fluttershy, there's Applejack, Twilight Sparkle, Princess Celestia. Right, I probably name a lot of them right now. Because we just put up a bunch of the decals on the wall, and the girls thought that was pretty awesome.
So where can people find you talking about these ponies?
Oh, okay. It's basically on this podcast, so at GatheringMagic.com, MTG Potpourri. Email me again, MTG Potpourri at GatheringMagic.com. Or we have a Twitter feed for this page, which I just randomly hijacked to use for myself. That's at MTG Potpourri.
Or the best use, Tom, by the way. I love that you're running with it.
Yeah, if you ever see me use, you'll never see me use MTG Potpourri, so don't ever, that's never me. It's
always done. If you want Kylie to expose you to himself or whatever it is with his bumps, bumping his exposures, I was like,
"That was hey, that's our dredging humor. Those are old friends. You remember dredging?"
I know this. I just sounded funny when they want you to expose themselves with your bumps.
I mean, whatever. I'm good at that.
You are good. I've seen the videos. Or you can my personal Twitter is PSG Reader, which I also randomly use.
I'm going out with a bump. Everybody bump me. Bump.
Get it in there, Adam. Oh God, animal has three fingers. Why is that?
I did.
Just all right, guys.
No, we already bumped.
Oh, one more thing. No. If you've stuck it all the way through to the end, and you're watching us on YouTube.
Oh, I stuck it all the way through.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If you stuck it all the way at the end here, you watch us on YouTube. If you like MTG Potpourri, if you think we're doing something good, or you think we can do something better, or you want to ask us to take a look at something next time, go ahead and hit a like. And give us a comment on the show, and I'd be glad to make sure that we take a look at that next time.
So many double entendres to end this podcast with. So we're going to stick it to the end. Yeah.
I don't know. This one didn't even go up on YouTube. It's got too many innuendos.
It has
good mouthfeel, though. Really solid. So I think we should go with it.
I'm really happy.
It is solid, yes. So
thank you for listening. Thank you guys for putting on a good show, and I guess we'll catch you next time.
Yep, and since we are running long on time, I will save my 2-minute mystery until next episode. But I'm going to ask for you guys to vote, and also listeners to vote. Do you want me to read The Case of the Dead Professor, or The Case of Death at Sunrise?
Well, they're both cases about death, so I mean,
yeah, do you want a dead professor, a dead teacher?
I vote that next time. I don't want to sway anybody's vote yet. I don't want to give anybody, you know.
I don't know. I just this might sway your vote, but it just reading the first couple sentences of The Case of Death at Sunrise, it does have a character named Nick the Nose. I think he won Death at Sunrise. Just a hint.
All right, until next time.
All right. Oh, God. Oh, The Case of the Death Plunge?
Hang it up,
Tom. All right, we'll see you guys later.
Good night, everybody.
Push the buttons.
Oh, French Vineyard?
Push the buttons.
Hotel Murderer? Lost City? Murdered Wife? Oh. And we're done. How do I stop recording?